We're considering this morning the subject of suffering. The subject of suffering is an interesting subject that affects all of us to some degree, because we all have been acquainted with suffering to one degree or another, and certainly we know of those who are suffering. And all around us we see a world that is suffering. And what I want to do is take two of these particular verses, verse 23 and again in verse 28, which are my subject headings this morning, two things that we know. We know, number one, that all of creation is suffering. Now again, Paul uses the words "we know" in the same way that we would use a phrase such as "we know absolutely," or "we know without a question," or "with beyond the shadow of any doubt." And that's the Greek word that Paul chose to use in this passage. And we have started a series called "Things That We Know," things that we know absolutely or for sure. And Paul uses the word twice here. He actually uses it four times, but I'm only considering two of them. In verse 22, "we know one thing, that all of creation is groaning and travailing in pain together until now." And then in verse 28, "we know that God causes all things to work together for good to those who love Him." Now let it be said that there are those who deny that suffering really exists. In philosophy, almost any philosophical book, if it gives a thorough treatment of the subject of philosophy, will have at least a chapter or so given to the subject of suffering. Why does evil exist? Is it possible for an all-powerful and all-loving God who created His creation to begin with to also make room for evil and suffering to exist? And that's a tremendous paradox and conflict that philosophers have tried to deal with for the last umpteen centuries, from the very beginning of time. Now there are three basic positions that you can take regarding the subject of an all-powerful, all-loving God at the same time coexisting with the subject of suffering and evil. Number one is you can be an illusionist. As an illusionist is simply one who denies that suffering really does exist. A syllogism would be something like this. If God were all-powerful and all-loving, then He would not allow evil to be present. Furthermore, God is all-powerful and all-loving, therefore evil is not present, or evil does not exist. Now there are those of Christian Science background, there are some even today who are part of the positive of or the power of positive thinking approach, who simply deny that evil exists. And they say it's all a matter of the mind, and it's simply matter or mind over matter. And so you just think evil out of existence and it won't be there. And there are many who can be even on their deathbeds who simply deny the fact that suffering or evil exists because they cannot rectify that with an all-loving, all-powerful God. Now there's the opposite pole or opposite extreme, which is atheism. And atheism says it's impossible for an all-powerful and all-loving God to coexist with evil and suffering. We know that evil exists, that suffering exists. Therefore, an all-powerful, all-loving God does not exist. And that's the position of atheism. There is a third position, which happens to be the Christian position and was the position of the Apostle Paul. And certainly we see it here in this 8th chapter of Romans. That is, and I put it this way, if God is all good and all-powerful, He will defeat evil. Evil is not yet defeated, therefore, one day we assume that evil will be defeated. And that's what Paul is telling us in this 8th chapter of Romans. We know presently that suffering does exist. We know that we also have an all-powerful God who is even able to take suffering and all things that we encounter, and turn them into good. We simply cannot bury our heads in the sand and say that suffering and evil does not exist. That would not be true to the subject. Sin and suffering of all kinds exist, and our newspapers and TV newscasts are simply filled with tragedies and sufferings of all kinds. And we well know that it's hard to find any real good news in our society today. It's real. It cannot be denied. And everywhere we look, there are problems. Someone recently was talking about Colonel Gaddafi's bodyguards, and he said, "You think you have problems? What about Colonel Gaddafi's bodyguards?" Can you imagine how they'd feel saying, "Gaddafi, duck," if they needed to? You see, it's fitting that we would consider this subject on Memorial Day weekend. As we reflect on the thousands of dauntless, brave men and women who have given their lives in the service of our country. And the price for our freedom, as I prayed, has been great, and we must never take it lightly. We can only pray that they did not die in vain, but it's time for Christians to, number one, stand up for that which is righteous. It's time that we humble ourselves and pray and seek His face, as 2 Chronicles 7:14 tells us. It's time we stand up for truth and righteousness, and it's time that we get involved in the political processes of our country, because even in our own age, we have seen the regression of our own society in our lifetimes. Now, we want to consider these two great parts to this great theme of suffering and developing a Christian perspective on suffering. Number one, in Romans 8, verse 22 and 23, we do know that all of creation groans and labors with birth pangs until now. God has a plan for creation. And I want you to see that Paul is extremely optimistic. He's hopeful. He's dealing with reality. Suffering does exist. And he says all of creation is presently suffering and groaning in travail, like a mother that's about to give birth to a child. That's reality. But at the same time, Paul is able to see beyond the present, and he sees that God has a plan for all of creation. And he pictures all of creation here in verses 19 and 20 as sort of craning the neck, anxiously looking, peering off into the future to see what is really going to happen when the sons of God come into the fullness of their own inheritance. When the sons of God are revealed, and literally he means when the sons of God are put on display and exhibited before the whole universe, all of God's creation, he says, anxiously awaits for that day to come. All around us we see corruption. Paul doesn't deny that. In fact, he uses this interesting phrase in verse 21. He says, all of corruption, or all of creation, will one day be delivered from the bondage of corruption. All of creation, he says, is enslaved to corruption. I can't think of a more vivid way of describing our present world other than the word corruption. Everything that we see will at some point suffer corruption. You say, but wait a minute, a new baby is born every second into our society. And so there's new life that comes, but we might also say the opposite and say, not only is a new life now among us, but there is a new life that is already in the process of dying. Everything experiences corruption. Even our long-held national pastimes, such as baseball and other sports, suffer corruption. Corruption at some point enters in. Someone recently, in writing and sort of lamenting the fact that there is so much corruption in our professional sports today, said, sports provides a unique and invaluable service for America. If it wasn't for Major League Baseball, how else would our kids ever learn how to spit? Stop and think of how corruption affects every segment of our society. Everywhere you walk through a forest and you see signs of corruption. Oh, every spring we go through the process once again of new life springing forth as the flowers begin to bloom and the grass comes to life and the trees begin to bud and there's beauty all around us only to experience corruption in another few months. And certainly all of us experience corruption physically. There's a built-in misery in nature. And that's what Paul's writing about here in these verses. A built-in misery in nature. Listen to the cries of the animals in the middle of the night, shrill sounds. Animals feed upon animals. Some become prey. Others become predators. We know now as we look at creation that it's not as God designed it to be, that somewhere something is wrong, but God will ultimately rectify it. On top of all the misery, you have the misery inflicted by man upon the nature around him through the pollution of his environment. Last week I saw a special on the Great Lakes and all of the fish now that in our bodies up there, the Great Lakes up in the north, the Midwest, are now experiencing, these fish are experiencing cancers of all kinds simply because of the chemicals and the pollution that has infiltrated those lakes. And even our best scientists are saying it may be too late for the Great Lakes to be saved. All around us we see pollution, we see corruption. Things are not as they will one day be. The prophets foretold of that coming day. When the Messiah comes, when He reigns, the curse will have been lifted, and all of animal life, all of God's creation will experience a rebirth, a rejuvenation. He says, the wolf shall dwell with the lamb, and the leopard with the kid, and the calf and the young lion, and the fatling shall lie down together, and the cow and the bear shall graze. And the lion will eat straw like the ox. And the weaned child shall be able to play upon the cobra's den. And the nursing child shall be able to put his hand right into the viper's den. And they won't hurt or destroy in all of my holy mountain. For the earth shall be filled with the knowledge of the Lord as the waters presently cover the sea. Oh, the prophets wax eloquent as they speak of that coming glorious day when the curse will have been removed from all of God's creation. And then things will be as God intended them to be when He created before the fall of man. Now, I want you to look briefly at verse 22 before I go on to my next point. We know something. We know something that the world doesn't know. We know that the whole creation groans and labors with birth pangs together until now. You may look at that and you may say Paul was a pessimist. He's not seeing any hope for creation. Just the opposite. He uses the analogy there of a very expectant mother. And even though the labor seems to be long, and there's tremendous pain, and there's tremendous effort, yet the end result will be that there will be new life. And Paul sort of looks at all of the groaning in nature at this present hour, and he sees it as just simply a foretaste of better things to come as all of creation anxiously awaits for the coming of that great day. We know something. The groaning is short-lived in view of the long life of the baby. And the groaning quickly turns to joy when new life comes. We know that. The second thing Paul says we know is in verse 28. And we know that God causes all things, or that all things work together for good to those who love God. Now, all through this passage, and I would encourage you sometime during the course of this week to read it and think about it, because I'm just trying to set the tone of the passage here this morning. All throughout this passage, Paul is bouncing back and forth from groaning to glory, and he sees a correlation between the groaning and the glory. And in this present world, there's going to be a lot of groaning, but all of the groaning is simply preparing all of God's creation and the believer himself for that coming moment of glory. He says in 2 Corinthians chapter 4 and verse 17, "For our light affliction, which is but for a moment, works in us a far more exceeding and eternal weight of glory." Again, back in verse 18, "I reckon that the sufferings of this present time are not worthy to be compared with the glory." Trying to compare the present sufferings with the ultimate glory is like trying to compare any one of our incomes with the income of H. Ross Perot. There's no comparison. Absolutely no comparison. He says, "Even we ourselves groan." Look in verse 23. Not only the creation here, all of God's creation, but he says, even we ourselves, we the first fruits of the Spirit, we who are God's people by call, even we ourselves groan within ourselves, waiting for that day to come. We do a lot of groaning. We really do a lot of groaning. And contrary to popular Christian belief today, the older you get, the more you are going to groan. Why? Because you, as a new man, as a new woman, ever being renewed in your spirit and in your mind, according to 2 Corinthians chapter 4, verses 16 through 18, yet you are still living in the same old body. When God saved you, He didn't do anything to your body. And He won't until that coming day when we shall be changed, our vile body shall be changed and made like unto His glorious body, according to the working by which He is able to subdue all things to Himself. But until that day, you're going to live in a body that is subject to corruption and decay and disease and ultimately death, just like the rest of the world. You're a new person living in the same old body. And you're going to fight with that. I groan all the time. I groan the older I get, I must confess. When we climbed out of bed this morning at 5:15, I groaned to Connie. I said, "I got to start this process one more time. Getting ready. Getting in the shower. trying to get yourself awake. You know, I've watched all those soap commercials and they don't work for me. Yeah, you try a certain brand of soap and you just get in the shower and you just spring to life, you know. I've yet to find a soap that has that effect on my life. And the older I get, the more I groan about having to go through the process. But it's necessary. There are times that we experience more than just the inconveniences and the hassles of everyday living. We experience disaster. I mean, what the world and what the Christian would call disaster, it's there. An accident that takes a loved one or perhaps even several loved ones. And it is a tragedy that defies explanation and it defies reason. But in the midst of what the world calls a tragedy or a disaster, in the midst of that horrible thing, I can have hope that somehow, I know some way, my God is going to come through in the end and the story is going to be a happy ending because my God is able to do that kind of thing. Romans 8, we know that God causes all things to work together for good. Now, I don't want you to misinterpret that verse. He's not saying God causes all things. God allows all things. God does not cause all things, but He allows all things. And a good illustration of that is from Job chapter 1. God allowed Job to be afflicted, but God did not cause it. Satan was the one who brought on the affliction. God simply allowed it. But in the end, God was able to take all of Job's afflictions and bring him back and restore him and give him twice what he had before. Had a happy ending. We know something the world doesn't know. Paul says, I'm letting you in on a mystery. I'm letting you in on a tremendous secret for God's people, and that is that we know that God is able to take the worst circumstances in life, and He's able to weave them together throughout all of the fabric of life, and in the end, He is able to produce something beautiful and use them for good. We all remember Roger Staubach when he played for the Cowboys. You know, the Cowboys, through the first 58 minutes of the game, could be behind by 30 points. But we would hope. We would hope. Why? Because Roger Staubach had that two-minute offense, and we knew once they started the two-minute offense that somehow Roger, our boy, was going to come through. Now, he didn't always come through. But we expect a Superman. We want a Superman. We want a hero. I believe that God has put that desire in man's heart to want a happy ending, to want someone to be able to take all of the circumstances and tragedies and vicissitudes of life and bring them all together and make something beautiful out of them in the end. That's exactly what Paul says God not only can do, but He will do, and He does do. You ever looked at a watch? Not these present quartz watches, but take apart an old watch. You take that apart and you look at that watch and you say, a madman made this thing. I mean, it's got wheels going one clockwise, another counterclockwise, and one up here, and it hooks in with this thing here and this sprocket here, and somehow that sprocket runs this wheel down here and this wheel runs that wheel, and it's running in all different directions, and you look at it and you said, he must have been the same man that designed our highway system. It just doesn't make sense. He was a madman, a maniac that designed it. But you look over, you look on the face of the watch, my, it's beautiful. Beautiful. It keeps time. It keeps time. There is a plan. There is a plan there. Corrie ten Boom uses the illustration of the piece of embroidery. You look at that embroidery on the one side and it's just a mass of endless disconnected seams and strands of material running in different directions. Seems to be no plan or design, but then you turn that piece of embroidery over and you see this beautiful, beautiful picture that has been woven together. You see it, but only when you get to the other side. And Paul is telling us here that we will see how good God's plan was, and we will see how He's taken all the misfortunes of life and He's weaved them all together, but we won't see it until we get to the other side. It's too beautiful. Illustrations of that in the Bible. One is Joseph, my favorite Old Testament character. This story, how he was hated by his brothers, sold down into Egypt, mistreated while he was there, falsely accused in Potiphar's house, imprisoned, but God was with him in each one of these circumstances. And God ultimately vindicated Joseph, and he became the second in command in all of Egypt, and ultimately was responsible for the salvation of his own people during the 7 years of famine. Jesus, of whom Joseph was but a figure in the Old Testament, likewise. was hated by his brother. He was mistreated by his brother, and he was handed over to the Gentiles. He was verbally assassinated. He was physically assaulted. He was nailed to a Roman cross, but God vindicated him after 3 days, and ultimately God used that cross for the salvation of the entire world. You think that we have a God who isn't able to take all things and work them together? Our God is. Amen. Our God is. And it's fitting that we would consider this subject on Memorial Day weekend when we think of the countless lives that have been destroyed on behalf of our country, and not only our country, but around the world. It's nothing. Our whole history of mankind is simply a history of warfare and bloodshed, that something has gone awry. But it will not always be that way. And in the midst of all of life's circumstances, God has promised not necessarily that He will deliver us from the circumstances. We're going to continue to groan. But God has promised that He will give us peace. Peace. We want to conclude our service this morning by doing something a little differently. I want you to bow your heads. Joyce Sang is a missionary from Venezuela, and we had the opportunity to do some things this week in a rest home. And Connie and I would simply like to lead you in a couple of songs dealing with peace. And I want you to sing with us as we sing together. And I would like for us to bow our heads and make this a time of worship as we worship together and ask God to give you peace no matter what you're going through.
River attendeth. unceasingly flows. O'er my soul like an infinite God.
Join us on comfort or rest, marching down the rough pathways of life. Make Jesus your friend ere the shadows grow dim. Accept this great peace in life. Sing again. Continue in worship. We're going to ask the ushers to come at this time and receive the morning offering.